I'm Paul Ramsey. I'm speaking to the C.S. Lewis Committee for the lecture tonight and introducing our speaker. In the process, I'll get the privilege of speaking briefly of three remarkable men and a group of men that's been very pleasant to work with. I'd like to thank the committee that's worked on this, that's been, I'm a member, George Connor, Douglas Coutts, Henry Henniger, in particular Dr. Charles Hummel, who has been sort of our guiding, the inner varsity ministry, who has been our guiding spirit through some years of the committee. Committee work is not my favorite task in college, but if all committees were like this, it would be. It's a very, very pleasant committee to work with, and I hope we have done good things. Lewis, as you know, was a remarkable man with great range in literature, in knowledge of science, with a philosophical kind of genius, and the power to speak of the Christian faith to a very wide audience with great success. Also a remarkable man with a remarkable and even enviable job to some of us who like to hang around libraries is the speaker, it says on your schedule, is speaking tonight, Lyle Dorset, who is a curator at Wheaton College of some very fine papers of C.S. Lewis, Dorothy Sayers, of Tolkien, of G.K. Chesterton, and others. And it would be wonderful, it would have been wonderful, to hear what he had to say. But he's not speaking to us tonight. He had the courage and the determination, but his doctors said otherwise, and he tried up to the very, till this weekend he thought he might come, but his doctors wouldn't let him. He's been recently in the hospital. And so we have a substitute tonight. And I get thereby to speak of another remarkable man. The substitute is George Connor. George Connor has thought about Lewis a long time. He's taught Lewis. He's reflected on Lewis. His life has been affected by Lewis. And George Connor is a remarkable man in many ways. He's the author, co-author, fine book on, and again this seems to fit Lewis very well, on discovering modern poetry. He's the author of, I think, a beautiful, mature, reflective book called Hints and Guesses, which was published in 1982, and consists of a number of religious essays. He, as many of you know, was a very important person in the university, a very helpful person in the university for many years. He's now Gary Professor of English and Emeritus. He has been very active, communicant at St. Peter's Episcopal Church, and therefore is with Lewis in the Anglican tradition, as that tradition speaks to a wide variety of traditions and people. Then he's remarkable in other ways, and some of you know what some of those are. Lewis had a great gift, and it was a varied gift. Part of that gift, the gift of mind, the gift of devotion, the gift of goodness knows energy, was something that this speaker shares. And that is the ability to speak plainly on difficult subjects and sort of move through, get through, put aside pretension and jargon and confusion and speak to the heart of matters. And he will have a chance talking about someone whom he admires a great deal, C.S. Lewis, George Connor. Thank you very much.
I need to retrieve my notes. I should have foreseen that. In spite of that little act of thievery, I'm grateful to Dr. Ramsey for his extraordinarily generous words. I'm afraid words that arise from the generosity of a longtime friendship more than from any other source. I want to begin, ladies and gentlemen, by saying to you that if you feel some sense of disappointment in the absence of Lyle Dorsett on this platform, I join you fully in that disappointment. Not only because I had looked forward to hearing him and to being the beneficiary of his detailed and expert knowledge of C.S. Lewis as the curator of his papers at Wheaton College, but also I am put, I think, in a reasonably embarrassing position. I had been going hither and yon for the last 2 weeks saying to people, you must come to the C.S. Lewis lecture. In fact, I appeared by telephone on the program of the world's most famous disc jockey on Thursday morning. I don't know, I don't remember the figure that for Luther Massengill's percentage of audience, but it's a mistake. It's 100 or a little better than 100%, because it seemed to me for 3 or 4 days I met nobody who did not laugh uproariously and say, I heard you. I didn't quite understand the laughter, but anyway, the program is certainly widely heard. So please remember that I share your regret. And understand it very well. My remarks are really going to be in two parts. First of all, I'm going to make some background and summarizing comments in an effort to put Lewis in some kind of context. And secondly, I'm going to talk about three qualities which he seemed to exhibit and to relish, really, in his own life and in his work. Dr. Ramsey has already said what a remarkable figure Lewis was. I think in almost judged by any criteria, he is a unique Christian figure. I've never been able to think of anybody who was anything like a precise parallel, either during his own lifetime or since his death. There are certainly people who are reminders of Lewis. There are certainly people who share his interests. But nobody, I think, with the understanding of the faith and the ability to talk about it intelligently, there's just no rival at all. I think it's fair to say that he was not an original theologian. I think he would have been among the first to affirm that fact. But he was very skillful at exposition and at synthesis. Robert Frost says in one of his poems that everything comes finally to the test of the marketplace. And by this test, Lewis succeeds brilliantly. He has been dead now for almost 25 years. He died the same day that President Kennedy was assassinated. And despite this fact, everything, so far as I know, everything he wrote, certainly the specifically Christian books, are still in print. If you buy very many books and know the frustration of the rather whimsical way in which publishers can take a book out of print almost overnight, then you know what a remarkable record it is that of this vast production of Lewis's in his lifetime. Everything is still available. He is avidly bought and read and very widely quoted. I've tried on more than one occasion to think of some figure in the world of religion who has anything like the ubiquity of Lewis as somebody to quote. It seems to me that he shows up in place after place after place. I don't think there really is a close rival there. In every possible way, he is in the bloodstream of contemporary 20th century Christianity. And books continue to be written about him. It seems to me that hardly a season goes by that somebody does not offer us a new book on some aspect of his work, his career. For example, last year saw the publication of a brand new biography, a book called Clive Staples Lewis, A Dramatic Life, by William Griffin, who was his publisher. It's a curious book. I certainly don't feel free to recommend it to people who are being introduced to Lewis. I would assume that includes few people in this audience tonight. I think those of us who have some knowledge of him, and it doesn't have to be a detailed or exhaustive knowledge by any means, if we have some considerable knowledge of him, then we can provide the context which the book itself often does not include. It's made up, there is no narrative thread which runs through it. It's made up of discrete sections. And Griffin says some very interesting things. I don't think it's a great biography by any means, and I think for the neophyte, it would certainly be a very puzzling one. Nevertheless, I mention it simply because here is one example of the fact that the making of books on C.S. Lewis seems to have no end whatsoever. In 1977, to go back exactly a decade, there was published by Macmillan a selection of excerpts from Lewis's writing called The Joyful Christian. It includes 127 readings. All of us, I am sure, have encountered books that have been put together that way, always posthumously, of course, which are an attempt on the part of the publisher to capitalize on the reputation and to make a few more dollars. I think The Joyful Christian is a first-rate exception to that rather cynical observation. It is a good anthology. The selections are extremely well chosen. It's not cluttered with notes or anything of that sort. If there needs to be an explanatory note, that is usually very unobtrusively entered in brackets in the selection itself. And for the person who is seeking to get some grasp of the width of Lewis's interests and his Christian writings, and that's, of course, all that this book concerns, I think The Joyful Christian is a first-rate book, and I certainly can recommend it to you. I think Lewis can, with very real justice, be called a truly ecumenical figure. He was an Anglican. Even though he is dead, I find it difficult to use the past tense because in his writings and in our consciousness, he is still so much alive and so much with us. So I'll change my verb to the present. He is an Anglican with a following at every point of the spectrum, or if that's slightly extravagant, virtually every point of the spectrum. He is popular among Roman Catholics and the most avid of evangelicals. A demonstration of that fact is Dr. Dorset's affiliation at Wheaton College, which normally has the reputation of being a somewhat conservative institution. Frederick Buechner, when he was on the campus in November, did a speech to the Chattanooga Clergy Association in which he described to them interesting and compelling ways his 8-week teaching stint at Wheaton in the fall of 1985. And Mr. Buechner came away from that experience with very profound admiration for what he found there, for, among other things, the naturalness with which students could talk about religion, the obvious goodness of so many of the people he dealt with there, that I'm not seeking in any way to denigrate Wheaton College in saying that we think of it as a conservative institution. But it is the capital of Lewis scholarship in this country. They certainly have a more exhaustive collection of his papers than anybody else outside of Oxford has. And I think that fact itself reflects his almost universal appeal among all sorts and conditions of people. There is surprising testimony to his standing from Dr. Bob Jones, Jr. This is recounted in the biography of Lewis, which was published a number of years ago, written by Roger Green and Walter Hooper. Walter Hooper somehow ran into Dr. Bob Jones, Jr. somewhere in this country, knew that he had been at Oxford and had met with Lewis, and they had had a long conversation. And he asked him what his opinion of Lewis was, and he replied in these words, "That man smokes a pipe, and that man drinks liquor, but I do believe he is a Christian." I think that is wonderful testimony that the world does move. There is a fine story told about some honorary degree ceremony somewhere, and Lewis and an Anglican bishop entered a lounge afterwards feeling, and anybody who's ever been in an academic procession or academic ceremony knows the feeling of relief you have when it is over and you can take off those always warm gowns and so forth. And anyway, the bishop said to him, "Lewis, let's have a mouthful of," and Lewis thought it was going to be a mouthful of something to restore him, but he said a mouthful of prayer instead. I believe they went on to a different kind of restorative later. I would like to suggest to you, and I hope it is unnecessary for me to say that I would not abuse this occasion by using it as a means of Anglican proselytizing. That would be unthinkable and indefensible. But I would still have to say that I think it is a great mistake to underestimate Lewis's Anglicanism as a part of his ecumenical appeal. I think what makes Lewis an appealing figure is in many ways the result of his Anglican views and his Anglican position. And I say that and remind you once again that his appeal was almost universal amongst varieties of Christians. If you've read any of the books, you certainly know that already. People of the most diverse backgrounds have responded to him. So I'm not now trying to argue under some cover of darkness that it is only Anglicans who are really simpatico and who really understand and so forth. I'm not saying any such thing, but I am saying that his Anglicanism is a good part of his appeal to other people. I want to read briefly, actually it's an almost total letter that is published in the Joyful Christian. It comes from a little book of letters of his called Letters to an American Lady. An interesting enough book, but in some ways a puzzling one. I'll say more later about Lewis's habits of correspondence. But in this particular letter, he is writing to this woman. All the letters in this thin little volume are to the same person. And this woman had recently left the Episcopal Church to become a Roman Catholic. And this is Lewis's letter to her. "It is a little difficult to explain how I feel that though you have taken away which is not for me, this correspondent..." I'm sorry, that's the explanatory note. Let me start over again. "It is a little difficult to explain how I feel that though you have taken away which is not for me, I nevertheless can congratulate you. I suppose because your faith and joy are so obviously increased. Naturally, I do not draw the same conclusions as you, but there is no need for us to start a controversial correspondence. I believe we are very near to one another, but not because I am at all on the Romeward frontier of my own communion. I believe that in the present divided state of Christendom, those who are at the heart of each division are all closer to one another than those who are on the fringes. Let us by all means pray for one another. It is perhaps the only form of work for reunion which never does anything but good. God bless you. That letter always reminds me, when I look at it, of certain remarks which William Temple, the World War II Archbishop of Canterbury, made at his enthronement in Canterbury Cathedral on the 23rd of April, 1942. Temple was, among other things, one of the great ecumenical leaders of the church in the 20th century. It had been one of his passions, really. And he said, as a matter of fact, early in that enthronement sermon, that this worldwide fellowship of Christians was the great new fact of our time. And he also went on to say that the way to embrace a notion of an ecumenical church, which does not, of course, mean a super church, it means a body to which all of us belong and where all of us would honor each other's sacraments and would feel at home in each other's traditions in large measure. And Temple said, we will not be faithful to that concept by being less faithful to to the Church of England. It is only by being faithful Anglicans that we can take our proper place in the worldwide fellowship. And that's, of course, precisely the point that Lewis is making here, and it seems to me a very important point, that we understand that it is not by absenting ourselves from all the most profound commitments to our own faith that we find ourselves in sympathy with other kinds of Christians, wherever they may be found. One quality of Anglicanism, I think, which is manifested in Lewis and which is a part of his appeal, is the unwillingness to try to specify too fully or too strictly the essence of a dogma. I'll read you a brief paragraph or so from the introduction to this collection called The Joyful Christian. The foreword to it, this foreword is written by William Griffin, that same man who wrote the biography last year, or published the biography last year. What Lewis disliked about certain Christian doctrines were the elaborately prepared and elegantly served sauces like transubstantiation or consubstantiation for the Eucharist. Quote, the command, after all, was take, eat, not take, understand. That's the end of the quotation from Lewis. To him, too much definition could disguise or even destroy the basic content of a doctrine. And he noted with distaste the bloodshed in the kitchen where theologians with contrary recipes have been sundering each other for centuries. Although he thumped and thwacked every Christian communion for some excess of doctrinal enthusiasm, he also praised each of them for having one or another doctrine in its purest form. Discreetly, charitably, he almost never mentioned a denomination by name. Where historical or doctrinal controversies appeared, he was invariably to be found in the extreme middle. It is neither good actions nor faith in Christ that leads a Christian home. That's, quote, like asking which blade of a scissors is more necessary end of quote. It is both. This plainness, this mereness, that quotation comes from the book called Mere Christianity. This mereness of his theology makes him ecumenical in excelsis and helps explain why Christians of all sorts respond so enthusiastically to his work. A few years ago, browsing in the Interpreter's Bible, which is a very good place to browse, in my opinion, particularly the expository section is a rich mine of thoughtful, devotional material. I came upon a quotation from the American biblical scholar and translator James Moffitt, who was centered at the University of Chicago. I would read you this brief quotation because I think it says a great deal about the position that Lewis occupies in many of our lives and our minds, and also of other people as well. It is an acknowledged fact that Christian faith depends often upon belief in some guide or spiritual counselor who stands more effectively than anything for the reality of religion. Struggling aspirations may be reinforced, vague doubts may be resolved, and loyalty to the cause may be revived and purified as men are able to see their cherished end in the personality of one to whom they have good cause to pay grateful homage. And it seems to me that clearly C.S. Lewis is one of those people, but only one, all of us. Certainly all of us who profess and call ourselves Christians are in the debt of a great many persons. Our pastors and teachers, our friends, our families, our neighbors, our associates and colleagues, all of them have made, in one way or another, some contribution to our understanding of the faith. But Lewis has done this in a way which commends him to us as one of the truly great figures in 20th century Christianity. Now I turn to a brief discussion of three qualities in Lewis which seem paramount. I'm not suggesting these are the only three. Three always seems to be a sacred number. I don't know what it is, which impels us always to come up with 3 points or three arguments or whatever. There are a half dozen, but it seems to me that these are extremely important. Whether they are the most important, I leave you to judge. First, I would mention an intellect of the first order. A layman in another church said in my hearing a few years ago something which I had never thought about very much, and that is that he had never heard a sermon on loving God with the mind as we are commanded to do in the great twofold commandment. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. But we all know perfectly well, however often we may tend to let it slip our minds, that the mind is an instrument for use in understanding the world which God has made and God himself. And to neglect the intellectual is to be neglectful indeed. And I think when one reads the body of Lewis's work, one sees very clearly that here is indeed a first-rate mind at work. I think it's true to say that his conversion was essentially an intellectual conversion, and I think that's a rare thing. For most of us, it's a great mixture of things. I'm not suggesting, of course, that there were not other factors involved in Lewis's conversion. I think if one reads Surprised by Joy, which is the autobiographical treatment of roughly the first half of his life, or the first 1 or 2 years of his life, that one sees the process by which he is coming closer and closer to a Christian resolution, at least a religious resolution of the doubt in which he had been floundering. He had a conventional religious upbringing. He was born into an Anglican family. He was baptized and confirmed at the conventional age. But like a lot of bright youngsters before him and after him, he drifted away from the faith through a variety of influences. I suppose it's fair to say that as he came back through his mind, he also drifted away through his mind. And over a period of time, he painfully and slowly thought his way back. I want to read the climactic paragraph or so in Surprised by Joy, in which he talks about this conversion, and he is always, of course, extremely honest. That's one thing we have the right to demand, I should hope, of any religious writer, for that matter of any writer, that he be fair with us, that he be totally honest with us. And Lewis, it seems to me, never, here or elsewhere, pretends to any feeling or position or fervor or anything of the sort which he does not honestly and genuinely feel. This is at the very end of the chapter called Checkmate. What I'm going to read is the closing paragraph of that chapter. You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son, at least, walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape? The words compelle entrare, compel them to come in, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. But properly understood, they plumb the depth of the divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation. And it is, of course, almost from that moment that Lewis at least believes in a God. He's not at this point a thoroughgoing Christian, I think, by anybody's definition. I'm always a little uncomfortable to try to supply those definitions, but Lewis himself makes the point later that he goes with his brother to a zoo in London, and when he started on that trip, and this, by the way, undercuts my point about the intellectual, except that, of course, a lot of our thinking goes on subconsciously. When he started that trip to the zoo, he did not believe that Christ was the Son of God, and when he arrived there, he did. His brother adds to that the interesting fact that Lewis was riding in the sidecar of a motorcycle. I mention that for whatever guidance that might give to anybody who is struggling. I think what one comes back to in appreciation again and again is the simple and lucid, quality of his books. I mention three simply as illustrative. It would be fairly difficult, I think, to hit on a wrong example or a wrong illustration. But for me, at least, I would mention Mere Christianity, which is in itself, of course, a series of three books, really, but very thin volume. The Problem of Pain and Reflections on the Psalms. But the simplicity of these books is on the other side of complexity. It is not that he somehow found this magical way to deal with everything so simply before he worked his way through the complexities of the faith. And all of us who have attempted to come to terms with it, come to grips with it intellectually, know that it can be very complex indeed. And the simplicity of those books, as well as other books in the Lewis canon, is, as I say, simplicity on the other side of complexity. The books are informed not only by a first-rate mind, but also a first-rate imagination. I think myself, it's always very easy, of course, to make forecasts about what is going to be true 100 years from now. It's a cheap shot, I guess, always to do it. But I am perfectly certain that another century has passed, that the Screwtape Letters will remain a Christian classic. It may not be true of all. Theology, like a lot of other disciplines, has its fashions and its fads, and it comes and goes. But the highly imaginative quality of the Screwtape Letters and the masterful way in which they confront us with Christian moral theology, I think, makes that book a very certain candidate for permanence beyond any future which I can now imagine. I think it's going to be around for a very long time indeed. I suspect the same thing is true of The Great Divorce, although The Great Divorce has never been anything like the seller that Screwtape. Of course, it was Screwtape that put Lewis on the map, to use that cliche. It's the book that made him famous, actually. That, along with his lectures to the Royal Air Force in World War II. The Great Divorce is also, I think, a fine and imaginative book, a speculation about what life on the other side of the divide may be like. But he makes it very clear to us that it is speculation, that the geography of heaven not only does not interest him, but that he is not making any attempt to say, this is what it's going to be like. In imaginative terms, this is what the process is like. And Lewis himself regarded The Great Divorce as the neglected one of his books. And I think this is probably true. And a book which, while not as great as Screwtape, is also an extraordinarily interesting and an extraordinarily imaginative book. The second quality I would cite is the quality of integrity, by which I mean unity, completeness, wholeness, a life which is unified around a vital center of faith and belief. It seems to me that it's very clear, wherever one enters the Lewis canon and reads, that this is the kind of life he lived, and it seems to me certainly to be borne out by all the biographical essays and the full-length biographies and things of that sort. Dr. Ramsey commented on what a diverse and busy life he lived. It was indeed a varied life. In one fairly recent book with the rather curious title of C.S. Lewis at the Breakfast Table, there are 26 pages of bibliography in the appendix of that book. Now, it's perfectly true that some of the entries in that bibliography are quite brief things, But it is also true that many of them are not. And it's daunting to look through those 26 pages and to see what was possible in one lifetime. Great diversity indeed. He called it himself a mixed bag. But I don't think he was using that in any derogatory sense. He used that term in a response to the Milton Society of this country when he wrote and thanked them for electing him to membership, and then talked a little bit about the chief strains of his own writing. There were the scholarly books, because he was, of course, a literary scholar. There are the children's books, the science fiction, the Christian books. Very few people have managed the range of writing, the range of genres which Lewis did manage. And of course, he was more than a writer. He was a very busy teacher, lecturer under various auspices, not only university auspices, but national auspices of one kind or another. It's an almost impossibly busy life. And yet, if one looks at the letters, and they're a very good place to see what that life was most genuinely like, there are very few places that one senses any strain whatever. The only places I can remember at the moment were a few places when he would say to a correspondent, next week examinations, no letters allowed. He complained about heavy mail at holiday time and things of that sort, but those are the only hints that I see of anything except a very well-integrated life lived in calm and ordered circumstances without any real sense of strain. I think this comes through perhaps almost more clearly than anywhere else in the book called Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. This was a posthumous book. It was published, as I remember, in the spring of 1964, following his death in November, the previous November. And I think it is finally, definitively answered that Malcolm is no living person. It is simply a device which he used. It is not a pseudonym for some friend. It is an imaginative character to whom he's writing these letters. But imaginative or not, the details of his life, the orderly existence which he lived, the kind of discipline to which he submitted himself, it seems to me, come through in that book as clearly as they come through in almost anything, perhaps with the exception of the letters. Not only does the book have that virtue, but it is also an extraordinarily interesting discussion of many of the aspects of prayer. Private prayer, devotional prayer, not corporate liturgical worship, but they're talking about private prayer indeed. If it's a book that you haven't gotten around to, I certainly commend it to you. And of course, the explanation for this ordered calm of his life is the faith in which that life was centered. There is a certain childlike quality about it. I think one can see very clearly what our Lord meant by admonishing his followers that only as they became like little children would they be appropriately citizens of the kingdom of heaven. There is that childlike, not childish, which is a very different thing, but that childlike faith and openness and joy in Lewis that comes through very clearly indeed. I think, for example, and I meant to say, but my notes are slightly imperfect, but I meant to say of the joyful Christian that it's a perfect title, because it seems to me an unjoyful Christian is a contradiction in terms to begin with. Also, I think if one were looking for an adjective to describe C.S. Lewis, joyful would be a good adjective to use. He certainly was beset with rather more than his share of human frailty and illnesses, and various kinds of problems, some of which it seems to me he invited and allowed to happen to him, but that's another lecture. But in spite of all that, there is a joyousness which pervades his work as a joyousness pervades his life. Thirdly, I would mention the quality of human concern, compassion. The trendy word, of course, now is caring. A word that I have never warmed to for some reason. But there is in his life, very clearly to be traced out in the letters, for example, a genuine concern and reaching out to other people who indicate in some way, and sometimes it's a very slight way, some need for him or some way in which he can enrich their lives or say something meaningful to them. Frederick Buechner, whom I've already alluded to, but I find myself alluding to Buechner very frequently, and particularly since his visit, I think if we had nothing else in the centennial celebration to point to with great pleasure, the week that he spent on this campus in November is something which I certainly would never expect to forget in this lifetime, and which I think made an enormous difference to a very great number of people. That's a small commercial that I just drop in as unobtrusively as possible. But in his second volume of memoirs, called Now and Then, Buechner says, every once in a while, if only to keep their hands in, Christians are supposed to be Christ to each other for Christ's sweet sake. And that's a sentiment which C.S. Lewis would have accepted very gladly and have affirmed equally gladly. He very much shares and acts upon this understanding. I think it's quite impossible to read the letters without realizing this particular aspect of his life. Because there are so many people who ask his help when they are groping towards the faith, or indeed sometimes with some quite other concern. One of my favorite letters, for perhaps tangential reasons, is a letter which comes late in the book called Letters of C.S. Lewis. The letter is labeled "From a Letter to a Child in America," who had written to him at the advice of her teacher to ask him for his advice on writing. It takes a good deal of gall, I think, to set youngsters on a man as busy as Lewis was to ask foolish questions of that sort. But he answers it as though this is the most important question. One of the best examples I know about his willingness, his readiness to supply help when people ask for help is to be documented in the book published 10 or 12 years ago by Sheldon Van Auken called A Severe Mercy. Van Auken is an American who, along with his wife, was at Oxford in the immediate post-World War II years, in some sort of graduate program, or at least what would be an American graduate program. And he went, the word that he uses to describe himself and his wife and the circles in which they had moved in this country is the word pagan. He uses it over and over again. Certainly it was a life without anything that could be called the Christian faith. But interesting things happened to Van Auken as well as to his wife at Oxford. They fell in with a group of people who took the Christian faith seriously. It just happened, as far as I can tell from the record, that the couples, four or five couples and one or two unattached people who were their best friends also happened to be dedicated and committed Christians. And this said something to Sheldon Van Auken. It said something to his wife as well. In fact, I think in some ways she was somewhat more rapid to assimilate the faith than he was. There were more difficulties in his path. But he documents these difficulties very clearly in the book, The Severe Mercy. And just to be sure we won't miss it, the publisher, the cover says something like 12 letters or whatever it is from C.S. Lewis, and in the editions of it I've seen, C.S. Lewis's name is in much larger letters than Sheldon Van Auken's, because, you know, that would sell more books, and that's a matter which publishers are very sensitive to. But he quotes first a long letter which he wrote to Lewis, outlining what he sees as certain roadblocks in the way of his becoming a Christian, or his accepting the substance of the Christian faith. And Lewis writes him back at equal length, if not indeed greater length, a quite long letter in which he takes up the points one by one, answers them very carefully. It's a little essay, really, wonderfully well written, as everything I've ever seen that he wrote, no matter in what haste or whether with a draft first or not. And I just want to quote the final couple of sentences, because I think this is the essence of Lewis as a companion on the way. After this long letter of explanation and discussion, and he pointed out to Van Auken, of course, that Van Auken was in the position of longing to find himself in the faith, able to believe, in the position of being a true devotee. Lewis points out to him in his answer that that's precisely the opposite of his own position when he was working his way towards the faith. As he said in that passage I read to you, perhaps the most reluctant convert in all England. Well, at any rate, he ends the letter by saying, "I don't know if any of this is the least use. Be sure to write again or call if you think I can be of any help." That may seem to you routine. I suggest that it is everything but routine. Here is a man who is as busy as a human being probably can be. And here is somebody whom he has never met, never seen. Van Auken was not his student. He knew Lewis by reputation. He had heard that Lewis had been of help to other people. He turned to him. He begins his letter by saying, "This may seem very strange to you, and I may tomorrow feel that it's a mistake that I have written this letter." But then he goes on, and in response to this, and without any tie to Van Auken at all, except the tie that any human being has to another human being, and certainly we may hope the tie any Christian has to another Christian, he responds with this long and generous outpouring of comment and use of what must have been a significant amount of his time. There is another equally good example of this willingness of Lewis to respond to other people in the Griffin biography. He set aside a generous portion of his royalties, which were managed by his agent and his banker jointly, as I remember. At any rate, there were a couple of people who kept an eye on things. And time after time, in a letter to somebody, he will say, "Here is a case for the fund. Somebody who is in trouble, somebody who needs money, somebody who has fallen on hard times for one reason or another." And over and over again, he comes to that person's financial rescue. Reminds me of Rose McCauley's comment in her letters when her last novel, written within the last two or three years of her life, suddenly turned out to be a bestseller, and she, as she described it herself, suddenly found herself rolling in money. And she said, "It's a wonderful thing because now I can give almost as much as I want to." Which is a remarkable response to that particular phenomenon, I would think. Indeed, in the letters to the American Lady, that slender volume of letters that I mentioned earlier, this woman talks about her own difficulties, and finally, of course, she's in this country, and Lewis was in England, and the only way he could manage giving her money was to get his publisher in New York to send her a check every month, and that's what he did. And sometimes when you read that, you don't see her letters, you see only his answers, but you can infer her letters, and they must have been one unending stream of complaint about how harsh life had been to her. I do not find her a terribly attractive person, to be honest about it, but Lewis responded with the generosity and the magnanimity which set him apart. In two separate pieces of writing, it's clear that he deals with people in his life like his barber, like the man. He never drove, he never learned to drive, and he often hired a car, and always the same driver was assigned to him. And I read an essay 3 or 4 years ago that that driver had written about how marvelous the long trips, particularly the long trips, were, and all the discussions which he and Lewis got in. I don't think it ever occurred to Lewis to ask whether people were his intellectual equals or not. There was none of that kind of self-importance about him. He reached out to all sorts of people. And the essay called, What, The Efficacy of Prayer, I think, which first appeared in The Atlantic, begins with an incident about his barber, that he was supposed to go to London and the trip got postponed and he decided to postpone his haircut. And yet something kept saying to him, go on and get it. And when he went in the barber shop, the barber said to him, oh, I was so hoping you would come today. And I mention this not as a airtight case for the efficacy of prayer. I think one would need somewhat more evidence of this, as Lewis concedes in the beginning of that essay. But the point is that these people entered his lives not as functionaries, not as more or less faceless persons, but as quite genuine human beings. In the expository section of the Interpreter's Bible, if I can refer to that one more time, George Buttrick does the part of the exposition which deals with the parable of Dives and Lazarus in St. Luke's Gospel. And Buttrick says that the rich man, he's not really an evil man. He's not a cruel man. He just didn't see Lazarus. He wasn't aware of Lazarus. C.S. Lewis saw, and he acted as a result of what he saw. Well, these are only three qualities of many. And I have said, of course, very little of what one can say about this truly remarkable person. But I come back finally to a single phrase in the quotation from James Moffat that I read. Here is one of the people, certainly, to whom all of us who profess and call ourselves Christian owe grateful homage. Thank you.
If you'd like to talk some, you may even ask questions if you wish, and I'll be glad to refer them to Professor Connor. Okay. Can you hear the question? Did he do all his writing by hand?
I'm not sure that I know the answer to that question. I know he did some things by hand. He did not type. I know that. So I guess the answer inevitably is that he did. because his brother typed his letter, and he would say, Gimlin, can you hear me? I'll be glad to get back up on the platform. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah.
He would simply say to his brother, give them a very kind response or tell them thus and so, and the brother would type. So I would guess that that's right, that he did probably write by hand. I know he says to this child that you must write always with the ear and not with the eye. And so I would think the chances are very good, but I can't answer with complete assurance. Jane? I'm sorry, we have one here, and then we'll get back to that. What? I read some account in somewhere. One of them is in Australia, and one is in France, it seems to me, or Switzerland, or somewhere on the continent. Lewis was very fond of them, of course. He really took to those sons and to the whole domestic life in a way which people had not somehow expected a bachelor of his advanced years to do. You know, the joke in Oxford, the wife's name was Joy Davidman, and one of the losses that we suffered tonight that Dr. Dorset is not here is that he has done a book on her called And God Came In. But anyway, when the word circulated in Oxford that Lewis had married her, the joke was, you heard what happened to Lewis, he was surprised by Joy. Not a first-rate joke, but sort of an inevitable one. There was another question back there. Are you asking me? Are you asking what I believe or about Lewis? I'm sorry, I can't understand you.
I'm really glad to believe that he believed in me.
The question is, did Lewis believe in evolution or creation? I'm not sure that he would want to answer the question in those terms, frankly. It may seem a cop-out to say both, but there's some of both, it seems to me, in his views. Any other questions? I feel very vulnerable in opening the thing to questions, but yes.
In the last part of the small volume we spoke about, Letters to an American Lady, it's so poignant to me where he writes about his increasing debilities. Are there any other writings about last months?
Well, the biographies certainly treat the question was, are there writings about the last months? The questioner cited the comments in the closing pages of Letters to an American Lady. I think the letters, there are some things in the letters of C.S. Lewis, which is a fuller collection, and in the biographies. And of course, there have been so many essays done about him since his death, and a good many of those people have described the ending of his life. So yeah, I think there's a good deal of material about it. You know, he went through a period in the summer of 1963 when he was thought to be dying, and he was in a coma for a long period of time. And he writes to a nun named Sister Penelope that it would have been deliciously easy to have gone on, and he wasn't sure that anybody had done him a great kindness to bring him back. He said maybe Lazarus was the first martyr. Yes?
You know, you heard the voice of being in the middle of the middle. What do you think he would think of the present state of activism? Because he did write some things in God of the Doctor.
The present state of what?
The present state of activism today. Activism has changed a lot since 1963.
Well, that's a. I just have no way of being able to answer that question. I just don't know. I'm sure there are many things he would find to be opposed to. There are many things he would find to affirm. So I don't really know what his basic position would be. Certainly one can extrapolate from certain things. Of course, one of the famous books of the 60s and 70s, I forget exactly when Honest to God was published, I should think in the probably the last half of the 60s, and certainly his admiration for John A.T. Robinson, the Bishop of Woolwich, who wrote that book, was quite limited. He often referred to him as poor Woolwich. One reason being that he felt that Robinson really claimed in that book that people's view of God, their image of God, was a long bearded old man who sat on a throne or a chair or something, and that's a pretty, you know, that's pretty naive notion. And I don't know how many people, there may be some people here and there in the world who have such an image, but Lewis was unmerciful to that kind of thing. I'm sure he could find a good deal to complain of, but I think also he could find a good deal to affirm as well. Oh.
The Chronicles of Narnia, there's some debate as to whether they were Christian allegories or not. Do you know if they were or not?
Well, I don't know whether the word allegories can be fairly applied to them. Certainly, Lewis himself confesses freely enough in two or three different places. I can't cite any source, but certainly at least in two or three places, he confesses that I could slip in quite a lot of the faith in the children's stories. And I think he clearly does. But whether, I'm quibbling, I guess, when I say I don't know that I would apply the word allegories. I suppose the word allegories would be a fair word to use, but whether it is or not, certainly his intention, I think, is fairly clear. They're subversive. They're meant to be subversive. Oh, I think unquestionably they were Christian. I don't see how, given Lewis, I don't see how he could produce anything else. But of course, they are Christian in disguise, aren't they? I mean, they're not overtly Christian. They're not Christian in vocabulary on the surface. One doesn't. And all the better for what he's trying to do. Yes. I missed the last three or four words. A collection of Lewis writings. What?
Yes, here in Chattanooga area, is there any collection of the
Bible? Oh, you mean a library collection? Except just the library holdings, I would assume there are several of those, but there's no special collection that I'm aware of. But I would suppose that not only would the educational institutions, colleges and universities in the area, but also there are great many churches that have fine Lewis holdings in their libraries, and there's, of course, that sort of thing, but I don't know anything beyond that. Well, you really have exhausted my knowledge, and thank you very much.